All right, so thanks for inviting me. I'll tell you about, as Dan said, some kinetic decoupling stuff, and I hope to have a little time left at the end to continue a discussion that kind of got started, but there wasn't time during Tim's talk yesterday, about exactly what one should do with these effective field theory limits, how much I should, you know, believe that if I take this thing and I map it into every space, it's going to describe all the physics for me. So the kinetic decoupling bit, which will probably be most of this, has this archive number. It's work with Jonathan Cornell, who's a grad student at Santa Cruz, who we shipped off to Europe for the past year. Stefano and myself. So this, Tim gave me a very nice introduction. I don't have to spend an awful lot of time talking about these contact interactions. What I will do is just do a quick overview of some of the things that appear so Tim wrote, for instance, something like this. For one of the operators, another was this. And of course, there's a whole set of others that I can write down that respect all the symmetries. But as it turns out, if I look at this one a little harder, that's not yet respecting standard model gauge symmetries. Well, I have one of these is going to be left, the other is right. And if I like that there is SQ2 left somewhere in the universe, I need to solve this somehow. So the way we do this actually is to add a Higgs in here. Now I set that to a VEV. I imagine that probably since it's talking to some quark, I have a Yukawa coupling. This gets rewritten as a suppression depending on the quark mass. This can be very important for the physics I'm looking at. Actually, this with the quark mass in it is also exactly what you bound looking at direct detection.
So, but basically you're saying you're trying to make an estimate of the coupling.
That's right, yes, exactly. So this ends up being suppressed by some scale cubed, or if you like, the VEV and a scale squared. And this is just whatever scale squared. And it doesn't really matter how I parameterize it, because ultimately I drive some bound on it, and it's a number, and you can translate it into whatever language you like.
This is just a statement that scalar couplings go like the mass of the fermion involved, whereas...
Well, that's a pure guess, right? I could have some completely different Yukawa coupling in principle for this interacting with the Higgs because there's these dark matters here. And the reason I think this is a really good guess is because it's one of the few things I could imagine doing that will not completely screw up flavor physics without suppressing this to the point that it becomes uninteresting for the other things I'm looking at. And this is really equivalent to MFE. But it is very important to the phenomenology you end up getting out of all of the different searches. So
is there a reason you want to keep it as NQ or lambda cubed? Why not just leave it as some scale 1 or lambda squared?
I could leave it as the Yukawa coupling over lambda squared.
Okay.
As it turns out that when I go and talk about some coupling to hadronic stuff, I want an MQ anyway. So maybe if you like, I can rewrite this as the Higgs VEV and lambda squared, and then it's completely equivalent.
It's lambda cubed, it sounds like it's a high-dimensional.
In some sense it is, right? I mean, there's a Higgs in there. This is a higher dimensional operator than this one.
But then you should write all of them, you know, QQ bar, glue,
you know, more. Yeah, and that actually gets done sometimes also. But it got done in our collider papers doing this search, QQ bar, glue couplings. Or rather, Kaikai bar, glue.
No, so, the reason I ask is it's going to sound like the scales that you can strengthen are going to be different.
Yeah, they are,
right?
Yeah.
And
but they...
Why not just compare them on the same level? Why not treat them as... Just keep the dimensional operators on the same dimension, but it's lambdas.
Well, so I could either keep dimension six operators that work in the standard model, or I can keep up to dimension seven. And if I'm only keeping dimension six, I really shouldn't write this one down at all, is what I'm saying. This one really is going to be a weaker contribution to things because of the fact that I actually have a dimension seven operator that I've decided to hide as a dimension six one.
Another piece of perspective about trying to estimate sizes of coefficients is that unless you really have some idea what UV theory is, I think it's kind of an exercise in futility. In other words, if you have a UV theory, then you can estimate the size of the coefficients. But if you don't have a UV theory, then you don't really know. And so you can argue as to what you like better, but it's just an argument of preference. It's not really an argument
of preference.
Yeah, and I could call this a dimension six operator and put very small compared to one numbers in front of it. That's what I would have to do otherwise to do something sensible from a flavor perspective by replacing MQ over V by the Yukawa coupling, which is...
You're going to put flavor constraints in?
Well, if I want to worry about flavor constraints at all...
Are you going to?
I am not going to explicitly.
No.
But if I expect that, for instance, these 100 to 1,000 TeV type bounds on things matter... They probably do, right? I should write down a theory that isn't going to give me a whole lot of pain associated with that.
Maybe we can be agnostic and just say, okay, the operator is dimension six, and so I'm going to go
If I do that and I go and calculate the flavor constraints, my suspicion is they're going to be quite strong.
Okay. Let's
go
on.
Yes.
Any reason you're not considering scalar dark matter? And have dimension five
operators. I could rewrite these with scalar dark matter, just replacing the dark matter by linear, reduce the dimensionality of everything by one. The only reason I'm not doing it is because for this I chose to look at fermionic dark matter. There isn't a physics reason for that. So what I'm interested in really is the question of how big can substructure be, right? This is set by kinetic decoupling, temperature. So in order to make any sense of this, I need to say, what exactly do I mean by the temperature of dark matter at all? I can't be doing this just from a Boltzmann distribution, because I'm losing, because particle number gets conserved after a while. So I'm just going to normalize this way, which is completely ordinary. This is equivalent now to some integral over my base space density with a number density normalization. Let's see. 2 pi's go with momentum for me. Depends on who you ask. So this is the variable that I'm interested in, and the question is, how does this evolve? I can put some work into from a Boltzmann equation, and I end up, after I've rewritten it to be an equation for this rather than for the phase space density itself, with something that looks like this, of course, is within a normal FRW cosmology. Now, C of T is some coefficient from a collision term in the Boltzmann equation. And there are sort of two regimes where I can imagine that things are easy to calculate. If I set C of T to 0, I do a little bit of work, and I find that this temperature now does exactly what I think it should. It just falls off with A squared. And if I turn this up very high, it becomes even more clear that this is going to become the dominant term that temperatures will have to track. And usually we do this within some sudden approximation. I just draw, so if I have the temperature, this is T chi, this is T. This is the two are tracking. Actually, I should be doing this the other way around, right? It comes down from hot. And eventually...
Not if T is your x-axis, right?
Right. It comes down from both hot, doesn't it?
only a little t is your x-axis.
Yeah, yes. I keep getting myself confused as to which t exactly I'm thinking about. As this gets cold enough, this starts getting even colder. So that I break away from some 1 and drop a bit harder. This here we call the kinetic decoupling temperature within the sudden approximation. If you do these things numerically, actually we do end up calculating from this equation numerically what things are going to be, you find that this thing tracks very nicely. There's a gentle little curve up here. So the sudden approximation is, unless if I care an awful lot about what's going on right here, very good for what I want.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused about the fact that in front of the edge, isn't that a 2? Right? If C is 0 and you have no collision, it should go like 1 over A squared.
It does, in fact.
It should go like 1 over A to the 5. If you have a
No, but I don't have the algebra written down to go through and show it to you at the moment.
This is on a log scale?
T is normal time, cosmic time. Right?
T is temperature, right?
I mean the small t, the...
Yeah, this is time, co-moving time.
Co-moving, conformal time.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, that might be the reason.
That's probably where it is, yes.
And H is the Hubble scale.
Yeah, H is the Hubble rate, yeah.
So this is on a log scale, presumably?
Yeah.
And what's the slope there?
So the relation of these two, so the behavior of T continues on its normal path. This one falls a bit faster. This one falls with A squared, and this one, what does the universe's temperature do? Now it becomes a question of, at the moment, am I radiation matter dominated? This will actually kink again when I change.
T always goes like 1 over A.
Always goes like 1 over A, also in the matter. Because there's so much more energy.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. It's always the photon temperature that I have decided to measure, basically.
Good.
Okay. So now, how do I actually see this? And how does it affect anything I care about? I have to map this kinetic decoupling temperature. Let me call this, just label it so that we know what we're talking about in the future. I have to map that onto something that we're now searching for. And there are two effects that contribute to this. So I have, first of all, one thing that occurs is my WIMPs start with start having some viscosity against the rest of the fluid, the sort of standard model fluid, and then free stream. Now, calculating exactly what happens here ends up giving me a big pile of scale factors that I didn't even feel like copying onto my notes. The important point is that this gives me some scale, some wave number, and smaller scales than this get suppressed from this. And this goes like m chi over tkd to the 1/2. I have to normalize, I run things with scale factors to matter radiation equality and other things. This is the behavior I care about. The second effect comes from acoustic oscillations. If I'm strongly coupled to the plasma, I'm going to feel these acoustic oscillations still. And here I can just say, well, that means that I have some scale that when I am within one horizon distance, while I'm still coupled, so something like, I'm going to get damped out by oscillations. If I'm outside this scale, you know, the oscillations grow a bit, but they don't go away, is the critical point.
So I'm confused. So when you're dividing, like, the decoupling from the plasma is like a baryon proton and a photon.
And lepton, yes.
And that, so their interaction strength is much, much larger, like a proton-proton. That's a,
yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, they remain in a plasma for a long time.
Right.
And my question is, how long do the WIMPs feel what the plasma is doing?
Right. So here we're talking about a higher dimension operator. So the interaction strength is much, much smaller than those interaction, the plasma self-interaction strength. So I just don't know how you can get a sensible units for this.
Well, if I live in this region where the two temperatures are related to each other, it means I'm exchanging momentum enough.
Then you don't care.
Well, then I do. Then I feel what's going on in the plasma.
Yes.
So the only question is, for these operators, what's the TKB going to be? And is it going to be early enough that all of these scales that are suppressed are tiny,
right,
and I don't change very much?
So the TKB should be raised to the 1 over the radius of lambda squared.
Yeah, so what happens actually is within this collision term, this is where the particle physics is hiding, right?
So you're trying to say that we can precisely measure the TKD at that higher scale? It's a higher scale, like 100 GeV issue.
We can precisely calculate it.
We can calculate it, but I mean, I'm talking about experimental measurement. That is how you can get a constraint.
Well, the constraint is actually going to be on the smallest scale that collapses, right?
What is just the observed smallest structure?
So this, all I have to do to get from these to the observed smallest structure is to say what I'm looking for.
Experimentally,
are they
way bigger than?
Way big. Yeah. It's very big compared to these things. The real question is, what do the other smaller scales do to the observables that we have? We probably won't ever see. At least, if you took a complete cold dark matter, decouples very early model, you get extremely small structure, right? Hierarchical, way down to maybe order the WIMP mass. Really small. Earth mass size things. We'll never see them distinctly. But they will contribute to how much annihilation do you see, because there's these extra little spikes everywhere. They're part of these boost factors and so forth.
What about microlensing? Could one see these dark metal lumps with microlensing, or they are not sufficient to
come? Fermi does this 3 months in advance.
I've really tried to
ask. Yeah, that I haven't thought about. It does sound interesting.
What's the limits on what the experimental limits? So you're telling me this will affect indirect detection.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the experimental limit on it's coming from Lyman alpha or something?
The annihilation rates for
well, so
researchers.
This depends on your point of view a little bit. If you were maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, you might have been worried about missing a lot of small scale structure, because we haven't counted enough dwarfs that have stars in them and so forth. There you might say, maybe I am measuring this cutoff. We've later decided that this is maybe not such a big deal. But
need the community.
Yes. But who knows, maybe it still is a big deal and we're missing the biggest one and have smaller ones. That would be really odd. That I can't explain in terms just of kinetic decoupling, but. So to get these to a scale, I just take the amount of mass inside this radius at the time, right? So I have some rho over k cubed, which gives me something like the amount of mass that was in there. And now that scale can start collapsing. It's the smallest thing that ever will. So what does this thing look like? Where's the?
Can you just explain that one more time? What's going on there?
Well, so this is a
physics
of this?
This case, I mean, what's going on? The dark matter is.
So what happens at first is the dark matter smooths out to track the plasma because it's pulled out by the viscosity, and then as soon as I start decoupling, I can run, and I might still be hot enough to run out of deep wells until I cool some more.
Okay.
So those are the two effects that go in. And the calculation of this is more involved than I want to do on a blackboard. The critical point, to my mind, is that if I look at these two things, they have very different dependencies on temperature and on the mass.
So is this roughly the inverse of the Hubble scale at the time?
Yes.
Is it, can one say it's like silk damping, but for dark matter? Not for baryons?
So the free streaming effect is also important, right?
Yeah.
I'm not certain, actually, how I would make that mapping concrete.
It's just that you can no longer consider it as a as a well-coupled fluid. You have to take into account higher moments in your Boltzmann hierarchy.
Yes, it's behavior like this, and so probably it is about the same thing. Yes, yeah.
During the decoupling of photon electrons.
So all the particle physics, of course, is hiding in this collision term, which has a whole bunch of numbers, but ends up being sort of at least proportional to something like this. Where what I have here is scattering of dark matter off of a standard model particle. K is the standard model particle's momentum, this is its energy, and this is the Fermi-Urbose distribution. Depending on which particle it is I'm scattering off of.
Should be dimensionless, right?
There's a bunch of numbers in front of this, yes.
Dimensionful.
Yes. In particular, there's this. So all of the particle physics, all of the contact operator, just sits into this term here. And I can take this, run my numerical code that says, OK, when do these decouple, stick in the particle physics model I'm interested in, and get an answer. Yeah, this is just the Fermi-Urbose statistics distribution.
Does that ever matter for you? Are you going down to the lighting particles where you care about like poly blocking?
It doesn't come up as a big factor, no, because usually I want to scatter off something that's abundant, right? So that means that they'll have access to very high momentum modes.
You can just use the maximum Boltzmann
distribution. I could do that as an approximation, yeah. Which is probably a good approximation. Yeah.
Kinetic decoupling happens before PBM, so you have to assume something also there is radiation
illumination.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. So it's a big assumption. I wonder if you have any sensitivity later on to test this hypothesis.
To test the hypothesis that this happens before BBM?
Yeah, so you have to assume that it happens in radiation illuminated environment. You assume it may not be. Right? We don't know. Because this decouples usually before 4 MeV.
Yes, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's like the 3.5 or 4 MeV. So this is the, you know, same, I have been saying always that there is an assumption there. It's a big assumption. And anything you can see to test this assumption would be very nice.
So let's.
It's like making the assumption, you change a bit.
Let me show you what comes out of this in terms of if these are what's mediating my interactions, what is allowed.
Free streaming, you're assuming something to be free streaming. If you're free streaming, your kinetic decoupling happens in a different era. For example, if it's dominated by a kinetic term, if it is dominated by a scalar field that is oscillating, if it was whatever, any other.
Right.
Assumptions, scalar tensor.
Yeah, if I go to a more interesting early universe cosmology, or if I run down late enough that I'm after matter radiation equality, I'll get different behavior.
No, not the variation equality now, because this is already very late.
It is late.
No, it's very late, but the kinetic decoupling happens before.
Certainly, for these models, it does. If I wanted to solve the missing substructure problem, it might not.
Yeah, then you go down to like KeV temperatures, right?
You have to.
For BBN.
If I want the kinetic decoupling to be the explanation for the missing substructure problem, which may or may not actually be a problem.
No, that could absolutely no. I was saying only that this is an assumption, and whatever you do will depend on that.
Yeah, absolutely. This is sensitive to the early universe cosmology. Yeah, absolutely.
And I consider that plus. You have to assume something, but if you can see the variation, anything that you can measure that would tell you something before, from before BBN.
Yeah, that'd be exciting. So we need to first figure out how to find the tiny structures that this predict, and then it would be really exciting. So let me just show you what comes out of this, just plugging in the straightforward matrix elements that I get from these contact operators. So for instance, if I'm interested in, I'll plot this within sort of the model parameter space, in as much as this is even a model that you want to have a sensible parameter space for. If I first completely ignore the fact that, so probably this is generated by some particle, I'm going to have some bound that looks something like this, coming from LHC or LEP, depending on what I'm talking about scattering off of at the moment. If I've chosen an operator that does this, like say the scalar operator with quarks, I'll also get a bound that looks like this from direct detection, which at the moment means xenon 100 for either of these models that I've drawn. And the kinetic decoupling temperature actually is almost completely independent of the mass. I can draw stripes of it. One interesting point here, normally whenever I draw a plot within this parameter space, I have to start saying, oh, but none of these are actually looking at the same energy regime, so probably I can't rely on a comparison of any two of them. This is a case where two of these are looking at the same energy regime. Both of these are looking at low momentum scattering, direct detection, and the kinetic decoupling. So this is pretty robust, actually, deriving a bound here. If I'm going to scatter spin independently within my dark matter model, I get a bound on the kinetic decoupling temperature. And this is, you know, something like hundreds of MeV. Big. So people who have thought about the missing substructure problem at all will realize this means that there's just absolutely no hope of solving that here. But also it means I'm going to get big boost factors if I'm looking somewhere. Big meaning, if I'm being sensible, maybe closer to order 10 than order 1. But
what scale are you talking about? Milky Way or in the
clusters, in galaxy clusters.
Well, they'll be way bigger than 10 galaxy clusters.
This depends still on who you ask to run your simulations, actually.
No one thinks it's 10. No simulations have numbers that small for clusters.
So what I can tell you is that if I mention a boost factor above about 10, anywhere within the hearing of Joel at Santa Cruz, I get a very long lecture about how this makes absolutely no sense. Now, that just means that this is Joel's opinion.
But I don't understand how he could hold up. Okay. Just for those who don't know, that the more conventional viewpoint right now is more like factors of 1,000 than in cluster scales.
Yeah, this I've seen a lot of places.
Do you know why Joel disagrees?
I know he disagrees very vehemently, but I would have to ask him again to explain it to me. Why exactly he disagrees, what this is based on. So there's a couple of interesting bits that actually happen if I start asking questions about what actually is going on here in a model that xenon 100 can see. As it turns out now, I've actually In the first order, when I drew this plot, I did it wrong. I said, I'm coupling to quarks. Here's my decoupling temperature. Fact of the matter is that at 100 MeV, there's no quarks anymore. So I have to go and map this and actually talk to pions instead of quarks. You get some. So now the important point is that I'm going to get a different Boltzmann factor for pions because they're much heavier than quarks. But I can do this same thing that gets done for direct detection all the time, just with pions instead of nucleons. Evaluate this. This actually does exactly the same kind of thing it does in the nucleon case. This in the simplest approximation gives me, there's no reason an A should be downstairs. This.
Well, so you told us what the 100 MeV contour is. What are the other contours?
10 and 1,000. And actually, I mean, this is something that I failed to sketch for myself, so I might be off.
1,000 up, 10 is down.
Yeah.
So, assuming 10 now pions aren't around either.
Almost aren't around, yes. So what actually happens is, this one doesn't change too much when I go and do this correction. 10 comes down here instead of up here. Of course, if I'm also talking to leptons, no reason I shouldn't talk to leptons, then it becomes the electron that matters for most of this parameter space. Actually, for a long time, thinking about kinetic decoupling, people have always said, oh, well, this is going to be dominated by leptons because they're around forever. At higher decoupling temperatures, like the ones toward the top of my plot, it turns out quarks contribute just as much. This isn't a surprise. They're both relativistic. But one other thing I can do, and now this isn't for the scalar operator, but I'm going to cartoon it on the same cartoon because, like I said, I didn't draw the things to actually give you the right lines anyway. As certain people who may or may, some of whom may be in the audience, pointed out, if I write this down, I also end up inducing at some level this, right? Actually, it was pointed out backwards by these people originally. If I couple to leptons, I'm going to talk to quarks at some level. And I can draw in this loop contribution. So this now, if I call this lambda q, this is going to be 1 over some lambda squared e. The lambda to talk to leptons goes like this, summed over quarks within that square root. This is just setting my renormalization scale to be lambda q so that I don't worry about the, so I don't have to run the operator mixing. I just say, what is it? This could certainly be done much more completely. There's actually some electric charges here.
But the log must refer to a UV divergence, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I say, I don't know what happens above lambda q, so I'm only going to start here and...
Right, so you've basically assumed that lambda e is infinity at lambda q, and then you're running down.
Exactly.
Yes. Finite lambda e.
Mm-hmm.
But then you would worry that there is... I mean, so
there might be a lambda e here already.
Right. So as long as the log dominates, this is probably capturing at least order of magnitude.
Yeah, so this is only a sensible thing to do if I'm saying, for whatever reason, this dark matter couples to quarks. This is my UV model that I get in my effective field theory from whatever's coming above it. I'm still going to couple to leptons, and this is how much. And also there's something to be careful about because actually for some of the scales you probe as you run around on this, you might actually get a lambda e that's smaller than lambda q doing this calculation. So you have to be a little careful. But what this ends up telling me is, okay, this 100 MeV that's set by the pions, sticks around. There's enough pions around that that's bigger than the loop suppression, but this comes back up again. In the vector case, this would be pi scattering. And this is the electron scattering through a loop. Pulls that temperature back up again in model space. It becomes harder to decouple later. And if I come look at this mapping.
But xenon 100 cannot constrain this, right? Electron scattering.
Well, this is through a loop from quark scattering, right? If I start with something that just scatters as a loop, if I start with something that scatters purely with leptons, the loop scattering to quarks actually is also a constraint. I have this plot in the paper also. It's weaker. And I don't have to, and I don't get this suppression. I just sit right where I was throughout the whole calculation before I realized there was a QCD phase transition, because it doesn't matter to the leptons.
Sorry, it makes it easier to decouple later, right? I mean, you decouple later if you scatter off electrons.
Yes. So a weaker coupling, as I move up in this plot, a weaker coupling leaves me.
No, so compared to your previous contours without this electron loop correction,
right,
you
so
go down, right? Your contours should go down.
Well, remember, this is a weaker coupling as I go up. So a weaker coupling keeps me in. I need a really strong coupling to stay attached this long. And I can do this translation, and what I get is for the free streaming dominant part, I have some behavior with mass that runs on this plot. These are again log axes. And I have a crossover point where this now becomes more important. And now I'm dependent only on the temperature, so I flatten out. This contour now is something like 10 to the minus 9 solar masses. So if I'm interested in sort of WIMP scale dark matter, 100 to multiple hundreds of GeV, and I couple the quarks through things that at least do spin-independent scattering, there are spin-dependent operators and spin-dependent curves that give you bounds, then you get very smallest subhalos. And this is interesting for your boost factors. Maybe microlensing off something that's 10 to the minus 9 m sun is probably never going to happen, right? I don't see a way to measure these things directly for these sorts of couplings. So,
yes. What does this have to do with boost factors, that you have such small structures?
If I allow even smaller structures, it means I have more total structures within a large object. And that means that I should have more tiny little spikes that are giving me small enhancements and give me larger boost factors overall.
Usually the net amount of boost factor in a given halo or whatever will be logarithmically sensitive to the
mass.
Okay. I see that once the free spinning and so on, non-standard, really non-standard, as I said, as I was mentioning before.
Mm-hmm.
And there it can get extremely small free streaming lane. The mass of the smallest structures made with polar matter can be many orders of magnitude small than the usual cosmology. So I ask around all these specialists, like Thomas Frank, and also I ask Joel Freeman, if you could measure something, because if you could measure something in terms of a very large boost factor, we haven't have any signal from that matter for this, then you could have it as a test, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of putting the end very weird cosmology. And they all said that you couldn't see that. You couldn't see many also find smaller structures because they would be destroyed.
They're destroyed by baryonic physics or?
Destroyed by this, that, the other. And therefore, you cannot go much beyond what actually the standard cosmology you would find.
and therefore it cannot be used as a test. Now, I'm not being an expert, I don't know, but I really asked. That was about 5 years ago. I don't know if the answer changed.
I'm certainly not aware of a change to that answer.
Right, so they say that actually...
But it remains an
interesting question. Very small, it doesn't matter. But you could be much bigger.
Yeah, you could imagine if the boost factor comes out way smaller than we expect after having seen something. That would be interesting,
that
right?
That would be interesting, too. But actually, you cannot make it... I mean, they say that. I have no idea. So this logarithmic thing goes on so far.
Well, the logarithmic thing is probably still true, but the issue is that there are other sources of washout for smallest scale structure than just this.
No, I mean, people have tried to do this. I mean, there are various approaches. I mean, I used to write papers about how collisions with stars are a lot better at mass halos and things like that. And there's those things are all true, but they're also calculable and relatively tractable problems. And I think they're not completely unknown. We don't just have to give up. We can quantify our ignorance to a certain extent, but I mean, the statement that the size of the boost factors depends not insignificantly on how far this goes down, I think, is completely general.
So you would imagine that there is some scale that gets disrupted so efficiently that this no longer becomes the dominant thing for setting the smallest scale, right?
Depends where. In the cores of galaxies, yes. They all get wiped out. In the outskirts of galaxies, no, they're completely intact. So it really depends where you're
looking. Where you're looking, yeah. So the long and the short of the story, of course, is as Yang correctly predicted, these things always decouple far too early to do anything about something like a small-scale structure, missing structure problem. But you can still ask interesting questions about what the boost factor is going to be. And I think one of the most interesting points is that I'm now doing the same physics, just at two different cosmological epochs. So I should really think about direct detection type bounds as bounding when these things are going to decouple. If it can't couple more strongly than this, then I can't decouple later than some value. You know, whether or not there are other things that are going on, this one has to be at least so weak, right? Other things might hold me in equilibrium. If I write down anything sort of reasonable, I expect all of these lambdas are kind of comparable once I've done the appropriate normalization with a VEV here. You have to work pretty hard to get to something that isn't going to be constrained by a direct search that will give you very light decoupling.
From the xenon alone, 10 MeV would still be possible. Is it below or above the LHC line, the final 10 MeV?
That depends on which operator I look at, actually. Okay. So this is really a cartoon for any one,
yeah.
And there's a plot for each of the we did, I think, all of the parity conserving operators you could write down. Mm-hmm. And each of them has been written out within this paper. Yeah.
What's the boost factor again for this mass?
It's highly dependent on who you go and ask.
Well, it depends which system you're talking about. And there'll be a system where the boost factor is essentially one, nothing happens, and then another system where it's 1,000. So it's not one number.
This is not assuming any washout, though. I mean, what does it depend on?
Like, so if I look at one system, like say I'm interested in looking at the galactic center.
Yeah.
The galactic center has this huge spike, and small little spikes by rotating it are going to be of very small effect, right? If I look at the whole sky and I consider only our galactic halo, I might get a boost factor of order 1, but noticeable now.
Okay. What matters is like essentially the ratio of what the annihilation would be without subhalos to that with subhalos, and so take the Milky Way. The inner 10 kiloparsecs or something has a really big annihilation rate already. The subhalos tend to get destroyed. And as a result, boost factor is manageable. It's 1. Okay, there's no effect. If you only looked at if you backed up though and could see the whole Milky Way from afar, you might expect a boost factor of 20 or something, because the outer hundreds of kiloparsecs have a relatively low analogy range from the smooth component, but can be really important from the substructure. So the bigger the structures you look at, and the more you look at them in their entirety as opposed to focusing on a small piece of them, the bigger the boost factors are. This is why clusters have big boost factors and dwarfs have none, or almost none.
Okay, so for the corresponding gains that you expect in boost factors, which one is expected to give you the best signal? Like, do you get some really good signal from the outer edge of the Milky Way?
Well, sorry, the boost factor is effectively something that you put into this J factor in your search, right? So you can just say, what has the highest J factor? You know, on the sky, still the highest J factor for us from here is the galactic center. Right.
So yeah, so my point is that even boosting those things by factors of 10 may not...
Well, you get a much cleaner background also, though. So it becomes an involved question. Where do we think we can derive the best bounds? And someone who...
Bear in mind the isotropic background that Fermi sees provides a constraint to dark matter annihilation, which is not very much weaker than from dwarfs in the galactic center. Mm-hmm. And there, the boost factor is all important. So, it's not irrelevant.
Okay.
And if we knew what it was better through this sort of stuff and improved simulations and other sorts of things, we could probably make better constraints based on it. So.
And where does the one-ton direct detection bound lie? And what is the minimum halo mass?
Well, so my bounds go up by an order of magnitude in cross-section. So whether lambda is cubed or squared in my normalization matters a bit, but you can just shift by the appropriate factor on this plot. The appropriate root of 10. So the other thing I wanted to mention, I don't actually have any idea how much time is left, is from a different paper that has an error bar on its archive number, as it turns out. It is, let's see. Something like that. It's ongoing with Tim and Stefano. Just looking at exactly what does it mean when I say I'm going to assume this crossing symmetry. How reasonable is that to write down this operator, cross it, and believe this is the answer? So, as Tim mentioned in his talk yesterday, to first approximation, the answer is that's totally unreasonable for some more complete theory. But I could talk just a little bit about the actual effects that go into this. So first of all, just even if I am doing that, the answers are very odd. Imagine that I had some signal at a collider, a missing energy signal, a mono something. Lots of us would get really excited, right? We would immediately start trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean for everything else we're looking for? Maybe that's dark matter, so what does it do? There are two things I could guess that is. Just to pick two out of the ether. Maybe it's this one. Or maybe it's this one. Those are two, as far as we know from the collider perspective, equally likely guesses for what's causing an excess, assuming that it's dark matter.
I'm not sure I'd say that.
So there's all kinds of theoretical reasons for why I think maybe this one should matter or that one should matter more in terms of what do I think is most likely from other probes or from the theories that I like. But do I have a discrimination in my collider signal between these two?
Well, it's just that...
Certainly not at the cut and count level.
Operator on the left, some theory bias comes into the stop.
Yes,
operator.
Yeah, there's a lot of theory bias that becomes important.
That's suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And the operator on the right is not. So then if you... The effective theory that... you would get for the operator on the left would not be a good effective theory to describe the late sea collision.
Not terribly likely, no. So this one, exactly as you mentioned, would look like this for the normalization I'm used to. We can argue about maybe it should be lambda over Yukawa coupling over lambda squared again, but let's not. This MQ, because my proton is made mostly of light stuff, is a huge suppression. Actually, most of your rate for a monojet search at the LHC is coming from the B fraction of the proton for this operator. Something like 90% of your rate comes from that. We know that's suppressed because it's some loop in the PDF that's giving me the B. This one, meanwhile, doesn't have any MQ. So I would have to have a much stronger interaction in terms of what the suppression scale should be. It should be much lower for this one than this to give the same LHC signal.
You had a threat over there. I mean, it's...
Yeah, Vev lambda squared, sure.
No, but lambda cubed, that's... You base your arguments on that, right? And that's I don't say it's lambda squared b. So unless lambda is much, is of the same order as b, then you're right. But if it's not, if you have some TV particle...
What's d?
Huh?
V. Yeah, it's really just a different normalization. Since all I'm bounding is that product, I'm measuring one number for what is the rate that I allow, and then I can translate that and write it however I want. You're right that from a theory perspective, it makes more sense maybe to think about it this way over here.
Yeah, semantic.
It's not semantic. It's more than semantic. There's a reasonable range where you're actually saying something. This is what Ronnie was alluding to. And that range is different if it's lambda cubed or lambda squared. Yeah. But that is true. That's the only difference it makes. Because
realizing you're about to make the point I was going to make. So
yes, yeah. So that means that this lambda is going to be much smaller than this one. And if I now want to, instead of just sitting here saying, oh, well, that's weird. Why am I seeing something so strong at the LHC if I decide to believe this? If I want to now go and say, okay, I'm going to search somewhere else. What do I see? Well, the natural other place to look is maybe taking this. Maybe this one we could see something at the spin-dependent direct detection a while from now. This does spin-dependent direct detection. This doesn't do any direct detection except at velocity-suppressed levels. That's not the right place. Let's look at indirect detection. So I can predict the signal rate for these two things. This one would give me something sort of ordinary. It would give me something like... This is the parametric behavior. This one, unfortunately, goes to something else. It goes to my coupling squared times the mass involved squared times v squared. This has to have p wave annihilations. Now, coupling the fact that this, I think, is much stronger, I can now, doing annihilations, annihilate entirely to b's with no suppression. And there's no PDF to worry about once I've turned the process around. The difference in the signal between these two, having said, okay, I have a fixed collider rate that I have seen. These two differ by a factor of 10 to the 8 in what you would expect for annihilation rates and for indirect detection searches.
So another thing is that, so this is small because of small MQs, right, direct detection.
This is small mostly because of the small dark matter velocity in direct detection.
Sure.
This is small at the collider because of small MQs.
But I mean, if you want to write those at the clock records, you would write Google.
Yeah, there's a whole stack of other operators I could consider also. I chose these two.
They would behave differently.
Yeah, well, they would behave differently. Each one behaves a little bit differently. But I chose these two because they're kind of extremal cases. The difference between these two is 8 orders of magnitude. The others fall in between somewhere. So, okay, that's... How much time do I have? I don't want to keep people here through lunch, for instance.
You
can
wait a few minutes, really.
Okay. So... Then I'll just skip to the next interesting point, which is let me look at something more complete. and say, okay, so maybe taking time and reversing it gives me very different answers here because of the different velocities involved in the two processes I search for. I can ask, what happens also if I go to Susie? Everyone's favorite model of new physics, still. Maybe this will change after another couple colliders, but.
Maybe after another couple talks.
After Antonio's talk, I'm now convinced it's. I'm sorry.
I didn't see that talk. What was the confusion?
MSSM is lattice, he does that.
You have to get the reaction by watching the talk, because otherwise just telling you something won't create the psychological experience that it was there.
By the way, can I just ask a quick question? Isn't it actually the top form that dominates the
depending on what mass I, the collider production?
Yeah, the collider production over there.
So not if I'm doing, if I'm doing a monojet search only, okay. Then so the top produces enough other stuff that I tend to veto these events. But you're right that it's actually very
the top loop. I'm going by the top.
So yeah, there's also the interesting
Unwin and Aish that mm-hmm. makes this point. Then Aish.
So
I think it's only a factor of 2 or 7 or 8.
No, it's quite a bit.
It's big actually.
Big.
For the pure scalar operator, it was very big.
I was comparing it with the Gluon operator.
Yeah, it's very noticeable in terms of the constraints that actually.
If you include the top loop, you get.
Yeah,
you get a big effect. That's true. That's a very good point.
Just thinking yes. about Higgs production, right?
That yeah, exactly.
There.
So this is now pseudoscalar Higgs production, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, okay, so there might be a slight, but I guess it's still holds. Yeah.
Well,
probably the same.
I mean, yeah, it should be. So let me just choose a couple of cases from Susie, where I say that from a dark matter perspective, you know, that's an interesting way to do things. So there, I could imagine having the well-tempered neutralino case. That's one way to get dark matter right in Susie. I could imagine taking Stau cone annihilation.
Does the well-tempered scenario still work in regard to the direct detection constraints, and isn't that going to be killed this mixed scenario?
You have to worry about it. So question of where in mass do you put it, what are you tempering with, I don't think it's completely gone yet. But it is becoming very interesting, the right way to think about that.
Well-tempered. Or any way to think about that.
It's getting tempered again.
The other way that we know within sort of small mass dark matter to make things work out nicely is to put them on close to a funnel. So these are three different ways to go ahead and get the relic density correct. And then you can ask questions like, well, what are the LHC predictions for this? Well, let's start by saying, okay, there's not colored stuff close by, because then you have colored stuff production, and that's huge. Here, I can do sort of.
So we have, I'm sorry, so there is interrelation between black stuff and the basic stuff?
No, there is not.
Okay.
No. Here I get productions like this that might matter. These are the dominant electroweak production channels. If I have some well tempering, because now I have to have, say, Higgsinos low, I can make these things. I guess here I look for two Stau productions. And here I look at Higgs physics. I look for another Higgs, because nothing else needs to be light. If I just say, okay, I want to do a monojet search. I'm going to pair produce dark matter, do a monojet search. The rates for all of these are tiny, despite the fact that the annihilation rate is fixed in each of them. Well, the annihilation rate when I'm annihilating to make the relic density at least is fixed. Even in these different models, time evolution can make a big difference in the annihilation rate. So for the first, if I time evolve from when I made the relic density forward to now, where the WIMP mass is can matter some. If I imagine putting it close to the top mass. If I put it just above the top mass, nothing, then I get sort of the ordinary behavior. But if I put it just below the top mass, I now have, since the WIMPs are going vaguely fast as they freeze out, I have a small enhancement to my cross-section because tops become available to annihilate to. And this can change our today annihilation rate by a factor of about 2. And I can play a similar game with the funnel. If I'm just below the funnel, then I actually annihilate more efficiently in the early universe where I have higher velocity. And so now I should get less annihilation rate. If I'm above it, the exact opposite is true. It's harder to annihilate in the early universe than it is now.
I think there is a worst case, which is stop co-annihilation.
Yes, yeah. I could do stop co-annihilation. And then I need to go and listen to Antonio. Here, I can have, you know, zero annihilation today, the first approximation. So as I run forward in time, things change. If I move from one to the other, the LHC sees very different signals. I look for different things. And in some sense, the moral of the story is, if you have a theory you actually believe, what are you doing talking about these things at all? So these things are great for, okay, I have no idea what I'm doing. What I'm doing for what my theory is, but I do think that I have a freezing out thermal dark matter. Let me do the most trivial possible thing, and then I can derive bounds on it. But if I think I know a little more about the structure of my theory than that, I should probably take it into account. Actually, in these cases, having multiple different things to talk to, so here I talk to quarks in one case and electroweak bosons for how I would best produce it, for instance. You know, VBF is an interesting way to look at this kind of case. This actually goes beyond an effective, a simplified theory approach, where I want to say, okay, I introduce a coupling to one new thing, or to one type of standard model thing through this particle. In order to correlate things here, you need even more than just a simplified model. So we have to keep this in mind as we go and build complementarity probes, which this is the buzzword of the day, right? It's complementarity, or of the year, for snow mass.
So I think you're trying to convince us that when we look for dark matter collider constraint and direct radiation constraint, we should totally forget about thermal history, because they're so complicated as they're happening.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think the thermal history is decoupled sufficiently from the LHC that you can't draw a line and say, okay, the LHC has ruled out this thermal dark matter picture.
As well as your expectation.
You should at least be open-minded that the possibility of thermal history was not the standard radiation-dominated.
Well, even if it is the standard radiation-dominated picture, you have to keep open mind also to the idea that there's more than just the one interaction you see at the LHC. That's a very important factor as well.
But then if the connection of the direct, of the collider switch for the missing energy and the red hand state gets so complicated that you can't really convince yourself the missing energy you have observed that the collider is really the dark matter, right?
Not from just saying maybe I got the relic density right. I don't think you'll be convinced you have dark matter until you've seen dark matter that's out there actually gravitating things that we're looking at.
Nothing the LHC will do will convince dark matter.
Now, maybe that's not quite true. If I could actually tease out a Stau co-annihilation and measure the masses that cleanly enough, maybe I could say, okay, that looks awfully suspiciously like it works.
Basically, if you get lucky, right?
Yeah, if you get really lucky, you could imagine measuring a model where you've measured enough of the parameters that
you might
actually this
see
looks.
That it's probably the dark matter, but it's really
no. You still need to see the actual dark matter before you're convinced that you have the dark matter.
It would be suggestive, but it would not be proof.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Will.